the top of the agenda. I'm Julie Walker.
I'm Teresa Wersbianska for Pacifica Radio.
Good afternoon, Washington, D.C., Maryland, Virginia, wherever you may be tuned in. You are listening to Taking Action here on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. My name is Daniel Del Piélago, and as always, thank you so much for your support, for your listenership, and in general for making sure that WPFW stays on the airwaves and is able to bring you the news and music and programming that we know you love and that we love bringing to you. So thank you as always. I am very honored this afternoon to have Kim Johnson. She is the manager of public policy for the National Low Income Housing Coalition. We're gonna be talking about a lot of stuff housing related from a federal point of view, but also, if she indulges me a little bit on how that'll affect here, folks in the District of Columbia. So welcome, Kim. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me, Daniel. It's really a pleasure to be here.
If I know the Low Income Housing Coalition is a national organization, and of course, a lot of folks know about you all. But for those folks who may not know about your organization, could you tell us a little bit about the work that you do and your organization in general? That would be great.
Of course, I would be happy to. And again, thank you so much for the opportunity. And thanks to your listeners for tuning in. So like you said, my name is Kim Johnson. I'm the policy manager with the National Low Income Housing Coalition, or NLIHC. Don't worry, there will not be a quiz. You don't have to remember that acronym. But we are a national DC-based nonprofit that is dedicated to achieving racially and socially equitable public policies that ensure that people with the lowest incomes have quality homes that are accessible and affordable in communities of their choice. So what that means is that our team works with, and sometimes, as the case may be, against members of Congress and the administration to advance federal investments in affordable homes and in policies that help ensure that everyone has a safe, affordable, and accessible place to call home. So what I do as the policy manager is oversee some of our day-to-day work. Specifically, I work on tracking the federal budget and appropriations process, expanding access to housing for formerly incarcerated and convicted people and their families, and I help track implementation of the housing protections in the Violence Against Women Act. So for just a quick overview of what it is that NLIHC does generally, we educate lawmakers and the public about the need for targeted investments in deeply affordable homes, and we'll get to a little bit about what that means in a minute. We also mobilize partners, supporters, and members across the country to advocate for good housing policies and, of course, to stop bad policies from going forward. And our advocacy positions are really supported and undergirded by our research. So we have two seminal reports, The Gap, which looks at the national shortage of affordable available homes by income level, and Out of Reach, which calculates what we call the housing wage, which is how much someone would need to earn per hour in order to afford a one or two bedroom rental home at fair market rent without spending over 30% of their income on rent alone. What we know from that research is two overarching facts. First, that there is a severe national shortage of affordable and available homes for people with the lowest incomes. That's a shortage of about 7.3 million units of affordable available rental homes for people with extremely low incomes. So those are folks who are earning no more than 30% of their area median income, or who are living below the federal poverty line. And in addition to that shortage, we also know that simply people are not paid enough to keep up with the cost of housing. In 2024, on average, a household had to earn at least $26.74 per hour to reasonably afford a one-bedroom rental unit at fair market rent. And that number jumps to $32.11 per hour for a two-bedroom rental unit, compared, of course, to the federal minimum wage of $7.25 per hour.
Wow. Yeah, no, and I want to, I definitely have it on my list of questions here to ask you about the out of reach, specifically, you know, how that plays out here in DC, because I was looking at the numbers. And I mean, while we know the reality of what's happening, it's always, you know, really alarming to see them written down. And, you know, speaking of education, Kim, you know, I was fortunate to be part of one of the webinars that your organization put on recently to talk about, and this was right when, you know, a lot has happened over the past 2 weeks now. And this right when we started hearing about the potential freeze of federal funding and how that could affect, you know, especially housing especially for many people who depend on subsidized housing, such as public housing, Section 8, vouchers and the myriad of federal funding that goes towards making sure that, you know, people stay housed, right? There's a lot of improvement needed there, but at the very least, there is, at least we can depend on some of that funding. Could you talk to us a little bit about that and the Low Income Housing Coalition, you know, opinion or just, you know, what you all were seeing and why you decided to have this webinar to kind of ring the alarm, right? Like something is happening and we need to be aware.
Yeah, absolutely. So first, our webinars are biweekly as a way of really helping to get our messages out to members of our network about what is going on Capitol Hill. We knew going into this administration, as we had seen during the previous Trump administration, that things were going to kind of start coming at us fast and furious, and that there would be a lot of policies and proposals coming our way that would ostensibly negatively impact federal funding for affordable housing and homelessness services, or limit access to those programs for people who rely on them. And sure enough, like you said, Daniel, last week, the White House released the executive order announcing a federal funding freeze. And although, of course, that executive order is now held up in the courts and the OMB rescinded their memo that was instructing agencies on how to comply with that executive order, we are still expecting to see continued attacks on those programs coming up. So, you know, to your question, the executive order, as it was written so broadly that it effectively covered every HUD program, just about every HUD program, from community development to homelessness services to rental assistance and affordable housing construction, are all supported by some sort of a federal grant or contract. So an order ordering a freeze on any funding for federal grants or contracts would impact countless HUD programs and millions of people and communities who rely on that funding in order to keep a roof over their heads, to increase the supply of affordable housing in their communities. It is really difficult to understate how catastrophic a funding freeze would have been for the people, programs, and communities who rely on those federal funds. And the timing was also not insignificant. The proposed federal funding freeze, of course, came late on January 27th, just days before rent is due on February 1st. So the people who rely on HUD to keep a roof over their heads were really at risk of not being able to pay their rent. That, of course, would impact folks in the district. Later on, as kind of the fallout and the opposition to this executive order started to crystallize, we saw backtracking of like, oh, well, programs that provide direct assistance would not be impacted. But how is direct assistance defined even? Because a lot of rental assistance go to landlords as opposed to the directly to the households that they're helping. And so, you know, the backtracking was really a symbol or recognition of how much opposition and anger was drawn out of people by this order. And so we were really, really grateful to have that kind of standing webinar to help communicate the urgency of what was going on and frankly, provide clarity on the fact that, yes, your program is going to be impacted by this.
Yeah, no, thank you. And as I mentioned, for me, it was really, really helpful. You know, right after that, I got on the email machine and started emailing our allies, you know, our orgs here in the district that do this type of work. And you know, people were aware of it, but really helping to once again ring that alarm that hey, something is happening and it's going to affect our folks. So it was really, really helpful. A little later on, we'll make sure to share with folks how they may be able to access some of these trainings and all of the good resources that you all provide on your website. To be clear, you know, we're not out of the, you know, it's we're still in murky waters, as it were. We could still expect that some of these freezes, some of these cuts will affect folks in the near future. You know, what else are you all as things change, are you all keeping your eye on anything else, you know, that especially is going to affect folks?
Yeah, absolutely. So, in addition to continuing to follow the impact or the potential impact of a federal funding freeze and as it winds its way through the court system, how ultimately it's decided, we're also going to be paying attention to other executive orders and how they might impact access to HUD programs. So, for example, there are, of course, executive orders to undermine or terminate efforts around diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility. And that is going to undermine a lot of efforts to address and rectify historic and ongoing discrimination and racism in the housing system. For example, of course, the federal government played a huge role in perpetuating discriminatory housing practices and neighborhood segregation through policies like redlining. And so, by that same token, in order to rectify the harms of these policies, we also have to consciously act to create and implement policies that will actively undo those historic harms. And on undermining all of those efforts, we're just going to see progress take a step backwards. The hiring freeze on the federal workforce is also going to weaken HUD's ability to administer and oversee implementation of federal housing investments. You know, the staff at HUD, they're very dedicated to their work and their agency's mission and have deep subject matter expertise that cannot be easily replaced or replicated if folks leave. And this department is already under-resourced, understaffed, and overworked. And so as a result of this funding of the hiring freeze, we may see, you know, longer grant processing times, more administrative backlog, that can ultimately prevent people in need from finding the housing and other resources that they need. And of course, orders like denying the existence of trans or gender nonconforming people is going to put them at greater risk of harassment, discrimination, housing instability, and homelessness, which we already know that trans and gender nonconforming people are at an elevated risk of, which can literally, of course, put their lives at risk. And executive orders around attacking sanctuary jurisdictions, allowing ICE to enter sensitive areas like homeless shelters or domestic violence shelters, churches and schools is also going to put their lives at risks and create fear that will ultimately deter people from seeking the assistance that they need. And that's part and parcel of the plan, right, is to sow that fear and to discourage people from standing up and from seeking out resources that can help them. And in addition to all of those kind of executive orders, we're also, of course, paying attention to one, the federal budget process. The federal government has yet to pass a fiscal year 2025 funding bill, despite the due date being in early October. And so we are paying close attention to when Congress gets a final bill across the finish line and ensuring that advocates are weighing in with their members to protect federal investments in homelessness and housing resources. Right now, we're looking at about an $800 million shortfall in the proposed level of funding for housing choice voucher renewals. In the Senate bill, which is the higher level of funding, we need an additional $800 million on top of that Senate number in order to ensure that all vouchers can be renewed and that no one loses access to those vouchers that they rely on. Just to kind of cap things off, one other thing that we're paying attention to, too, is continued efforts from the Trump administration or Congress to undermine access to housing benefits through, you know, putting in place things like time limits or work requirements on recipients of HUD housing. We know that the overwhelming majority of recipients of HUD housing are already working or are people with disabilities or are elderly or are primary caregivers to a young child or a person with a disability. We also know that there will be efforts to try to separate or force evictions for families with a mixed immigration status who receive HUD assistance. That was, of course, a rule that we saw come up during the previous Trump administration that we're fully expecting to reemerge in this one.
Wow, so much to unpack there. I mean, I think from one of the things that once again to harken back to this webinar that I recently attended that your organization put on, one of the things that really caught my ear was around the, you know, DC has said it's a sanctuary city. But if I understand correctly, one of the things that the federal government is trying to do, the administration, is to withhold funding if folks, federal funding, we're not a state, but if a place like DC, does not collude, I guess, with ICE and immigration and those federal forces, that is just going to be terrible for the city. What we're seeing here in the district is, you know, quite a deluge of evictions, right? Because as you mentioned, and we'll get a little more into this with the out of reach report, you know, folks just can't afford the rents. And, you know, for a while there, we had some decent federal funding that was helping folks, stay housed, and then our local programs benefited from that influx. And slowly but surely, you know, we've been losing those funds. We this year we only had about $27 million in our emergency rental assistance program, and that for the most part has been depleted now, right? So that does not get refilled again until the next fiscal year, until this coming October rather. So a lot of months of insecurity for many, many people. What I take from what you're saying is, you know, we're going to have less people doing the work in the federal government. We're going to have, you know, a lot more, threats to the money that keeps people housed. And there will be less funding for people who are unhoused. That seems to be some of the big themes that are playing out. When we're already, it's not getting on my political soapbox here, but people were suffering already quite a bit under, not ideal situations, but definitely not what we're faced with currently. So we really do have to stay aware of what's happening. And, you know, that's precisely why I'm thankful for having you on this afternoon to once again help let folks get an understanding of what's happening. With that said, another interesting thing that I found on your website was you guys published, some thoughts on the incoming, the potential, because I don't think he's been confirmed yet, but the incoming HUD secretary. Could you talk to a little bit about, you know, what you all are seeing there and of course, what we have to watch out for?
Yeah, of course. So, yes, you are correct. Scott Turner is the nominated HUD secretary. He went through a confirmation hearing in the Senate Banking Committee 2 weeks ago, I believe. But has yet to be confirmed by the full Senate. Scott Turner is a former NFL football player. I think he did 9 seasons in the NFL. There were a lot of football jokes at his confirmation hearing. As someone who does not follow football, they were a bit over my head, but that's fine. Mr. Turner does have little background in HUD or in housing policy. He did serve as during the first Trump administration, running the White House Opportunity and Revitalization Council, where he really led the implementation of a program called Opportunity Zones. And so just for a little bit of awareness, Opportunity Zones are areas that have been identified as experiencing disinvestment, and identified as quote unquote economically distressed. And those areas offer additional tax incentives to developers who invest in those areas. Opportunity zones were first established in the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, so there's not really a lot of good long-term data on the impact of the program. But what is available suggests that opportunity zones may operate as essentially a tool of displacement and gentrification for existing communities and neighborhoods. There are not a lot of kind of guardrails around the program as far as ensuring, say, community input into what development is going on or protecting existing affordable housing and neighbors who have, you know, been there for generations. And so we know that Turner is a big supporter of the Opportunity Zones program. So we're expecting a big focus on Opportunity Zones from the Trump administration and likely from some of the leadership in Congress. I think it's important to note that opportunity zones, as far as kind of the data has panned out, in addition to not being or to being a real kind of tool for displacement, there also isn't a lot of evidence supporting the idea that it's helped with affordable housing development. And so it's not a program that I would think of or label as really foundational to helping us address the needs of the affordable housing needs of people. It's also important to note, too, that during his confirmation hearing, Mr. Turner voiced support for policies that we find is really antithetical to our priorities. So he refused to commit to protecting federal investments in housing and homelessness resources, and especially refused to fight for expanding those resources. He voiced support for an increased role of private equity in the rental housing market, despite their track record of problematic and tenant harming practices like raising rents, imposing junk fees, evicting tenants, and failing to maintain the quality of housing. He also endorsed creating barriers to accessing housing assistance, like implementing work requirements or time limits, which again are all policies that we saw proposed under the previous Trump administration. And so we, of course, also expect all of those policies to make their way into the administration's priorities again, including, like I said earlier, the mixed status immigration rule that would force families with mixed immigration status who receive HUD housing to either give up their housing assistance or evict the member of their family who is undocumented.
Wow. Wow. No, thank you for that. And that really caught my eye, the bringing in private equity, because we're already suffering from that, right? Around the country, what we've seen, especially major stream of my personal work is around public housing. And what we've seen is, you know, the move to get private developers, private equity involved in so-called the redevelopment of public housing. And what we've seen is, you know, a lot of evictions, a lot of displacement rather happening, and people not being able to return to their properties, right? And then of course, you know, that allows for a lot more different people, usually people of a higher tax bracket, to come into these neighborhoods. And just, you know, as with everything, make everything more expensive, essentially. I'm being very, very, just saying things here, but at the end of the day, what is really scary is that we will continue to see this onslaught, and have, the administration's, support of getting this done. So I think we really have to be mindful and aware of what's happening and who the power players are in this case, Scott Turner, who will, will likely be in charge, of HUD. And it in the effect that it will have here in the district, what we've seen as we've seen public housing go away, what we've seen is an increase in vouchers and people holding vouchers. And to a certain extent, that is a good thing because people are able to stay housed. But if there's no money to keep those programs going, what we're going to see is, a lot of people on top of the eviction problem that we already have is potentially facing a lot more evictions. Is that something similar where you've been seeing around the country?
Yeah, unfortunately. And one thing that I think you really hit on well is like we love seeing an expansion of vouchers, right? We want every eligible household who's struggling to afford the cost of rent to be able to access those vouchers. We also need to invest in the creation and preservation of existing housing, affordable housing stock, including and especially public housing, which is such a crucial resource for millions of families who need an affordable place to live, but has been so systemically disinvested that the families who live there aren't always even in safe, habitable conditions. And so, in addition to expanding the pool of available vouchers, we need to ensure that that existing housing stock of affordable housing is also protected and safe and decent quality for the families who live there. Going to be very much, I think, an uphill climb. I don't, however, want people to feel discouraged from continuing to do this very, very important work. I think that there's a lot to be said for making sure that your voices are heard, for showing up at events and pushing for increased resources and continuing to weigh in with Congress, which I know, in DC feels
A little different.
bit hollow, yes, I understand that. But the fact is, any advocacy, any work that you're doing is important. It is important not to cede power from ourselves. It's important not to give that up. And it's important that we know that we do have the power to protect people and to make a change.
No, that's right. That's right. And this is precisely why, we do this show is to make sure that we are giving folks, those tools and the information necessary to take action, to fight back, and to do something about the situations that they're faced with. So thank you once again. Folks, you are tuned in to Taking Action here on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. I am joined this afternoon by Kim Johnson. She is a public policy manager with the National Low Income Housing Coalition. We've been talking a little bit about some of the threats to affordable housing that are faced by the round of executive orders that we've seen over the past couple of weeks, and very good information that we should all be mindful of and be following. If folks want to, check out the work that that the National Low Income Housing Coalition does, how can they find out more about you all?
Yeah, absolutely. So our website is nlihc.org. And we have all of our resources, information, advocacy toolkits, research reports housed on that website. For folks who are interested in seeing the ways in which they can help weigh in with their members of Congress or other elected officials on the importance of housing investments, we also have a Take Action page, which is simply nlihc.org/take-action. We have a number of campaigns and other initiatives too that folks might be interested in plugging into. So first, we have an Opportunity Starts at Home campaign, which unites cross-sector allies in fields like food security and civil rights and education in the fight for affordable housing. Our partners in that really recognize how foundational housing is to achieving all of the other kind of metrics of success, right? You can't really, it's hard to get a quality education when you're not sure where you're going to go to bed at night or where your next meal is coming from. And so when we ensure that everyone has housing, it becomes a lot easier to build up and achieve those other goals. We have a Disaster Housing Recovery Coalition that's doing really trailblazing work on identifying and advocating for needed reforms to the nation's recovery system. A lot of our work is focused around ensuring communities impacted by disaster experience an equitable recovery. Historically, people experiencing homelessness and those with the lowest incomes have also had the least access to resources in the wake of a disaster. And we want to ensure that communities impacted by disasters are able to rebuild stronger and more resilient than ever. And we also have a state and local innovations team that tracks state and local policies that advance affordable housing and tenants' rights. And of course, speaking of tenants' rights, we have a tenant leader cohort that brings together an incredible group of people from around the country who have founded tenant unions and who have really dedicated their lives to working to protect the rights of their neighbors and communities. All of those are different ways that folks can plug in or learn more about the work that NLIHC is doing.
Thank you for that. And that's one of the things I appreciate about you all is, you know, there's a continuum, right? It's from the grassroots all the way to, you know, all the way to Washington, D.C., as it were, right? At least the federal government and that type of advocacy. So I really do appreciate that. Folks, as I mentioned, we are discussing some of the threats really to housing here in this country and in the district. If you have a question, a concern, want to share any story, please give us a call, 202-588-0893. We may have a little time for a caller or two. I also wanted to ask you, though, Kim, and we touched on this a little earlier, but the out of reach, I think I may have said out of touch, but that may make sense as well too. Because some people are definitely out of touch with, you know, how much it takes to actually just be able to have a place to rest your head in the evenings. But talk to us a little bit more about the out of reach report. And then I'd like to ask you a couple of questions just about how it looks like here in the district.
Yeah, definitely. Out of touch, I'll run that by our we can update the next edition to that. So like you said, Daniel, Out of Reach is one of our really seminal annual reports that we put out. And like I mentioned at the top of the call, Out of Reach looks at the housing wage, which is how much someone needs to earn per hour in order to reasonably afford a one or two bedroom rental home at fair market rent. And when we talk about reasonably affording something, we mean they are spending 30% or less of their income on housing costs alone. We know that folks who are spending over 30% are often also struggling to make other ends meet because so much of their income is going towards housing alone. That doesn't leave a lot left over for other necessities like, you know, medical care, nutritious food, school supplies, transportation costs, let alone saving money. And so one of the things that Out of Reach points out is that in 2024, on average, a household in the United States had to earn at least $2,674 per hour to reasonably afford a one-bedroom rental unit at fair market rent, and $3,211 for a two-bedroom rental unit. That, of course, is compared to the federal minimum wage of $7.25 per hour. And I think that it's really important to note that 14 of the nation's 20 largest occupations in the U.S. pay median wages that are less than the one or two bedroom housing wage. 14 of the 20 largest occupations, that's I think 63% of the workforce, is not paid enough to meet either the one or two bedroom housing wage. And so we hear a lot of politicians talking about workforce housing, but often those descriptions are really aimed towards middle-income families. When to me, workforce housing is everyone, right? If we start targeting those resources to the people who need them the most, then we're going to see some of the financial stress alleviate across the board. I think it's important to note too that because of historic and ongoing discrimination in the labor and housing markets, Black, Native, and Latino people, people with disabilities, and women are all disproportionately represented among those lower wage jobs and among housing cost burden groups. And there was one other thing too that a couple other points to highlight on our opportunity starts at home. Or out of reach report, sorry. So even after taking into account states and localities with higher minimum wages, the average minimum wage worker in the United States has to work 113 hours per week, which is more than three or almost three full-time jobs in order to afford a two-bedroom rental home at fair market rent, or 95 hours per week for a one-bedroom rental home. And there's not a single state, metropolitan area, or county in the United States where a full-time worker earning the federal minimum wage or the prevailing state or local minimum wage can afford a two-bedroom rental home at fair market rent. And when we look at those kind of that big picture of how many people cannot simply do not make enough money to afford rent, it is really no wonder that so many people are struggling and so many people are hurting. This is affecting the majority of people who are just trying to make ends meet in this country.
No, that's right. Thank you for that. And what I really appreciate about the Out of Reach report is that, if you go to the website, NLIHC.org, and you search for Out of Reach, or it should be right almost on the landing page, I think, but you can definitely find it on there. There's an interactive map where you can you find your state, your area, and you can see the data for your city or state. I was able to find DC's, and one of the alarming things here is that working at a minimum wage of $17.50 an hour each week, you have to work 79 hours to afford a modest one bedroom rental home at fair market rent. That is so much. And just hearkening back to my work with public housing, not people need more than a one bedroom, right? Like, there's families here in the district that need larger bedroom sizes, three, four, up to six bedrooms are needed sometimes, right? And so if people are spending so much of their money and their time on just being housed, it causes so many different issues, so many ripple effects on mental health, on physical health, well-being. And then, of course, this I don't think this takes into consideration all of the other expenses that folks have to deal with, right? Groceries, health care, and just, having some fun, right? Everybody deserves to enjoy their life and be able to go out and have a nice dinner somewhere, or enjoy a new pair of shoes, or something that brings a little bit of quality to your life. If we're having to work so much and pay so much, it does make all of those kind of things really out of reach. So really, really alarming data here that we see that's not necessarily getting any better anytime soon. And as we've been speaking for the past hour now, there's a lot of threats that we really have to be aware of. So thank you so much for sharing that. And make sure to check out that website if you want to. I know we have listeners, we're based here in the district, but we have listeners in Maryland, Virginia, and our signal goes out far and wide. So if you are tuned in, make sure to check that out and see what's going on in your respective states and localities. I wanted to also talk to you a little bit about the report that HUD does on an annual basis, if that's okay, around the I believe it's called the point in time, or help me.
Sorry, the annual point in time count. That's the annual homelessness assessment report from HUD.
Yeah, so you know, I think the district just engaged in doing their own count very recently, and I'm waiting to find out what the results were from there. But in general, can you talk to us a little bit about what that report found, and you know, how it relates to all of this stuff that we've been discussing?
Yeah, absolutely. And yes, you're correct. The annual point in time count took place last, I believe, Tuesday night. And so for folks who don't know, what happens during the point in time count is essentially volunteers in communities across the country go out to various shelters and places where people experiencing homelessness tend to gather and set up tents and encampments, and basically just talk to people and count them and see how many people are experiencing homelessness. And so that's how HUD kind of gets that snapshot of how many people on any given night are experiencing homelessness in the United States. And in the most recent report, the 2024 report showed that there was a dramatic 18% increase in the number of people experiencing homelessness over the previous year. So that brought us to more than 770,000 people in the United States experiencing homelessness on any given night. That is also the highest number on record. One thing to point to, though, as kind of an area of hope, we do continue to see a drop in the number of veterans experiencing homelessness. I believe we saw an 8% drop in this year when we saw, you know, an 18% increase in the numbers generally. And I think what is really important to point out in that is that the reason that we see the number of people, a number of veterans experiencing homelessness drop, is that we really invest in the resources and assistance that veterans who are experiencing homelessness need in order to leave homelessness and find long-term housing stability. Historically, we have continued to invest in those resources and those programs, and we see the results of it. I think one of the big takeaways from this AHAR report is essentially that when we continue to refuse to invest the needed funding, the long-term, large-scale funding that is going to be required to really address the nation's affordable housing and homelessness crisis, when we refuse to do that, we are going to continue to see more people suffer and fall into homelessness. That is the natural consequence of disinvestment in these important systems that are supposed to help people stay safe and housed.
Yes, no, thank you for that. Because, you know, it's it just to, you know, talk about what's happening here in the district. So what we're seeing is a lack of a disinvestment, what we're seeing, right? We're seeing money for, as I mentioned a little earlier, for the emergency rental assistance program, you know, things that are keeping people housed, we're seeing cuts to. And we are bracing to see what happens, you know, with this year's budget. You know, we've got our priorities and what we'll be advocating for, but coupled with, you know, existing disinvestment and then what could potentially happen on a federal level. And then, of course, the federal government has to approve what we do here in the district. So, you know, we're in for quite a bit. But I think that it is, you know, all a recipe for a potential disaster for many, many folks, because, you know, the political will isn't there. We believe that the finances are there, that the money's there, right? The money is always made for where there is a political will. But for some reason, one reason or another, we are not seeing an investment in the programs that keep people housed and safe. So we'll really have to keep, working on that. And on that note, Kim, as you know, as we begin to wrap up here, and once again, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. I think it's really important for the WPFW audience to know what's happening. You know, a lot of folks here are activists, organizers, are folks that do this type of work. So we want to make sure to always provide this type of information. But you know, from your point of view, and from and, you know, the coalition's point of view, what can folks be doing? I know we touched that upon a little bit. It's a little different here in the district, at least on the national kind of platform. But you know, what are you all suggesting? And once again, you know, what should we be keeping our eye on?
So first, just to keep showing up, keep weighing in with your member of Congress or members of Congress, depending on where you're listening from. Even when it feels hopeless or pointless, I do still think that there's a purpose to showing up and being either in community with people who are there to fight too, or to just make sure that your voice is heard in opposition to what's happening. Together during the first administration, we also opposed and defeated a lot of the Trump administration's most harmful policies. We never saw the mixed status rule come to publication because over, I think, 60,000 people weighed in opposition to it. We never saw work requirements come through on HUD housing because Congress needs to approve that. And thanks to people calling and weighing in with their members, Congress never approved it. We got our first win last week with the Trump administration rescinding their OMB memo, in response, of course, to the court cases and to the really dramatic outcry from the public about the importance of the programs that the federal government was proposing putting a freeze on. And so we have to keep pushing for those protections and to make sure our communities and our neighbors are safe and keep fighting for those large-scale, long-term federal investments that are actually going to get to the root causes of the affordable housing and homelessness crisis. So things like expanding and preserving the existing supply of affordable and accessible rental homes for people with the lowest incomes, making housing assistance universally available to those in need, creating and implementing a federal safety net to catch households at risk of eviction before they lose their home, because we know it is so much more difficult for someone to become stably housed again once they experience eviction, and ensuring robust and enforced renter protections to make sure that people are not unjustly removed from their homes or experience displacement. So together, I believe that we can continue to fight for all of those, even if the political will does not exist now. We're laying the roots and the foundation for building that political will to make sure that it exists when we do have the opportunity to push those programs forward.
No, thank you for that. And I think, you know, as it continues to get, you know, worse, I think it's going to affect a lot of people, a lot of people, even people who were supportive of, you know, this new administration and its so-called platform. So, you know, as you mentioned, there is hope, and there is a lot of ways folks can get plugged into, you know, at a local level, at a national level. I encourage folks to check out the National Low Income Housing Coalition's website. There's tons of great data and information on there. As I mentioned, they will publish their statements on, you know, what they believe is happening, and those can be very, very informative. And also, you know, as I mentioned, Kim, earlier, on that webinar, it was just amazing to see hundreds of people from around the country joining to hear what's happening, to give their input on what's happening. And you know, once again, that ripple effect of like, say, well, wait a second, you know, that's what's happening here in DC, and this is what they're doing or trying, you know, is always helpful. So very, very thankful for you and the work that you're doing and the work that the coalition is doing, and just I commend you all, and really once again thankful for having you on this afternoon. I really do appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for your kind words. You know, I feel very, very thankful to be at an organization like this to be able to make some to have some small role in ensuring people are kept safe, and in, you know, fighting back against some of the worst of the proposals that we're seeing. So I really appreciate your time, and of course the work that you all are doing too.
Well, thank you so much, Kim. Really do appreciate it. We'll make sure to reach out in the near future to give us an update on what's happening. I'm sure folks will really, really appreciate that as well.
More than happy to. Thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye.
Folks, we just were speaking to Kim Johnson. She is the policy one of the policy managers with the National Low Income Housing Coalition. We have been talking about the threats to housing here in the country and how that would look like here in the district. And we really do have quite a bit to be concerned about, and we really need to keep our eyes and ears open to what may affect our, you know, families here in the district and our city in general. So I encourage folks to, you know, reach out and ask questions that may have come up this afternoon. As folks may know, we are headed into our the city's annual cycle of oversight hearings, of the budget hearings, and those are going to be really, really important for district residents to raise up what is happening, what they're experiencing, and then, of course, what we'll need to keep folks housed in safe and decent housing. I would encourage folks to check out the City Council's website. You will be able to see there the schedule of the oversight hearings. I think the budget hearings will be published soon, but encourage folks to go to dccouncil.gov to check that out and see, you know, what is the agency that you think you need to testify about. So there are, you know, all of the district agencies will have an oversight hearing, the Department of Housing and Community Development, DC's Housing Authority, you know, you name it, the Department of Human Services. These are all agencies that are really important for us to be aware of and giving input to those folks who have some oversight power, right? If folks do not testify at these hearings, if they are not hearing your lived experience and what needs to improve and what needs to get better, they're just gonna continue doing the same. And as we were speaking about a little earlier, you know, the direction that this city is moving in, and that is reflected in the current budget, we're not headed in the right direction. We are seeing a lot of cuts to the programs that keep folks housed, that keep folks fed. So we really are going to need to be involved and take action around these issues. Empower DC is here to help folks, you know, become aware of what's happening and, you know, be able to organize and mobilize around these issues. So make sure to please feel free to reach out to me and I can put you in contact with the respective folks in our organization that can help. But there are also a multitude of organizations here in the district that are doing good work to make sure that folks have what they need. You can reach out to me. You can call me at 202-731-8634. Or you can email me at daniel@empowerdc.org. Once again, thank you all so much for tuning in. Hopefully you learned something new this afternoon, and hopefully you can use some of this information as we move forward in these tough times. In just a couple of minutes, we've got the news. Make sure to stay tuned for COVID Race Democracy, and we will catch you next Tuesday here at the same time. And thank you all once again so much for your ongoing support and making sure that this station that brings you all of the good information that you need is still around. So peace, everyone. We will catch you next Tuesday.
tell the truth about displacement, apartheid, and genocide, or our commitment to presenting jazz and all of its extensions, as well as other liberatory musical forms. Blues, hip-hop, house, WPFW has been an unwavering partner in the fight for social justice and the preservation of the culture. Now's the time for you to display your courage and commitment to truly independent press by donating during our Winter Pledge Drive from February 9th through the 22nd. It is with your generous financial support that WPFW, this emancipatory educational media outlet, continues to build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Good afternoon. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Here are some headlines for this hour. The United States Department of Education was founded in October of 1979 by then-President Jimmy Carter. The mission of this department involves fostering educational excellence and ensuring equal access for students of all ages. Now, President Trump is trying to eliminate this department. While the idea of abolishing the Department of Education or merging it with another federal agency is not new, the move has historically failed to get support from Congress. Rather, when presidents have proposed cuts to the department's budget in the past, Congress has resisted and appropriated more funding than what the president asked for about 71% of the time. But even if Trump succeeds in ending the Department of Education, it is possible that some programs and funding that predated the forming of the department could remain and shift to other agencies. That would include, for example, federal funding programs for kindergarten to 12th grade schools that help support the education of students from low-income families and children with disabilities. A normal day at a school in Sweden turned deadly today after a gunman opened fire, killing around 10 people. The fatal shooting took place at Campus Risbergska, an education center outside of Örebro, Sweden, for adults over 20 years old who did not complete school. Officials say the number of the deceased and injured may rise as investigations continue. Swedish authorities believe that the gunman, who reportedly died by suicide, acted alone. Speaking on today's tragedy, Sweden's Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson said, and I quote, "Being confined to a classroom with fear for your own life is a nightmare that no one should have to experience," end quote. Gun violence at schools is very rare in Sweden, but there have been several incidents in recent years where people were wounded or killed with other weapons, such as knives or axes. It's been 2 weeks since Joe Biden left the White House as president, and now he's headed to Hollywood, sort of. The former president has signed with powerhouse talent company Creative Artists Agency, or CAA, based in Los Angeles, California, to handle his professional life after leaving office. It's reported that CAA will probably focus more on Joe Biden's publishing and speaking engagements rather than movie roles. Biden was previously a CAA client from 2017 to 2020, between his time as vice president and his election in 2020. Richard Lovett, the co-chairman of CAA, said of the president's resigning, and I quote, "President Biden is one of America's most respected and influential voices in national and global affairs. His lifelong commitment to public service is one of unity, optimism, dignity, and possibility. We are profoundly honored to partner with him again," end quote. To the D.C. area, officials have arrested two airport employees after they reportedly leaked video of last week's tragic mid-air collision near Reagan National Airport in D.C. The two male employees, a 21-year-old from Rockville, Maryland, and a 45-year-old from Upper Marlboro, Maryland, have been charged with computer trespass, which is a misdemeanor, in connection with making an unauthorized copy of airport authority records. Airport authority officials did not specify how the footage was obtained or distributed, but the viral video aired by news outlets shows the tragic moment when the passenger jet and helicopter collided. The cause of the crash, which killed 67 people, remains under investigation by the National Transportation Safety Board. In today's weather, it's currently about 58 degrees in D.C. That's all for your headline news this hour. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Please be safe, and thank you for listening.